Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Excellent. Doing great.
Good. Well, I'm excited. We got a fun show lined up. Got a couple of things I want to check in on with you first. But before we do anything else, reading any good books lately?
Oh man, I have started a book that is sort of in my mind. It's like a companion volume to The Rational Optimist. It's a book from Stephen Johnson. Let me give you a little intro on him. Stephen Johnson wrote the book a few years back that we've mentioned on this show several times, called Everything Bad is Good for You. And it takes the contrarian argument in that book that things like video games and, all these, watching
cupcakes?
TV. And
I want to hear cupcakes.
Yeah, not cupcakes so much. But, television and video games and things like that are actually, they're good for us. They make us smarter, I mean, a good video game nowadays, it's not, you're not just shooting space aliens like in Space Invaders. You're solving problems, and these games are getting more complex all the time. Problem solving skills are required, and then even a television show. You got a show like Lost. You got to keep up with like 14 characters.
Intricate plot lines that they're making up as they go along, right?
That's right. Exactly. We wondered from time to time if they were had any goal at all in mind. It appeared at the end they did. But anyway, so that's the deal with that book. Well, he comes along and writes this book that I started. I only got about a chapter or so into it, but so far it has really got my attention. The title of this book is Where Good Ideas Come From.
Where Good Ideas
and,
Come From.
That's right. And, in some ways, I guess it's sort of, he's continuing with some of the ideas he had in Everything Bad is Good for You. And in this case, he's saying, living in a big city, people, always are trying to, escape big cities. Well, big cities are good. A metropolis that is 50 times bigger than a town. Let's say you found a town that's exactly 50 times smaller than New York City.
Right.
That town would be 130 times less innovative than the city. And the reason is that the greater networked city. The city has greater networks and therefore is more innovative than a town.
I don't doubt that rationale for a second, but I'm really intrigued to read the book because I want to see the math that leads to those numbers. Yeah, that's very interesting. So for 50 times the size, you get 130 times the amount of innovation.
Exactly.
Interesting.
He argues also, and he goes off on these interesting tangents to kind of prove some of his points. One of the things he says is we need to take our biological metaphors literally. And he says, for example, meme is a metaphor that compares an idea to a gene. He says, like ideas, genes compete. They, there's the survival of the fittest in both the ideas and in genes. but they also combine and cooperate to make a multicellular organism. And he says a body is like a city of genes, and that's where innovation can happen. And then that would be for one body. And then he says there are in nature there are cities. You know, there are for example, a rainforest could be considered a city in a way. There's more innovation in nature going on in a rainforest than in a desert. And he has some interesting ideas.
Interesting. So like a city is like a living body, and then the memes are the genes of that organism. Is that the idea?
Exactly.
Wow.
And so in a way, a gene is literally a meme. It's a group of ideas. That works in cooperation to build a body.
It's a
fascinating read so far. I look forward to getting further into the book.
You say it would be a good companion volume for what book? I'm sorry.
The Rational Optimist. You may have
heard of The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley. Speaking of which, let me give a quick update on our program, our project that we're all heavily invested in here to get 1,000 people to read The Rational Optimist. Well, we took a bit of a slowdown this week, and we've got 80 people in the Facebook group, and we've got 51 people who have committed one way or another to read it or have passed it on to someone else who is then going to read it. So we've made great progress. We're about a 20th of the way to our 1,000, but if you're listening to this, if you're listening to me talk right now, I am talking to you personally, whoever you are. If you're listening to this and you have not yet read The Rational Optimist, I'd like you to read it. I'd like you to get a copy, read the book, get an audio copy, listen to it, read it on your Kindle. There was a heck of a fine deal going for a while for the Kindle edition. I'm not sure if it's still free, but I think it's still a good deal. Read the book. If you've read it, pass it on to someone else. If you've passed it on to someone else, how about you get another copy and pass that on to someone else? And here's the most important part. Here's the part I can't stress this part enough. Let me know about it so I can add you to the list so that we can get to 1,000. So
that's right.
I highly recommend. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we might want to ask our guest if he is he has read this book.
Oh, when we bring the guest out, we're going to be hitting him with that. Don't worry.
Sure. Okay.
Before we do, I just want to share one quote from my weekly quote from The Rational Optimist, and this is actually a quote within the book. It's from someone else, and this is the line I'm going to read. On what principle is it that when we see nothing but improvement behind us, we're to expect nothing but deterioration before us? And this was written by Thomas Babington Macaulay, and the book was called Review of Southey's Colloquies on Society. So, interesting quote. I like the quote. And speaking of nothing but good things before us, stay tuned to the entire program. Not only do you want to be here for our entire discussion about seasteading, but coming up towards the end of the show, we've got a special announcement to make about the future of Fast Forward Radio, and I don't think anyone listening is going to want to miss that. So, having said all that, I think it's time for us to talk a little seasteading. What do you think, Stephen?
Absolutely.
Well, we're very, very pleased to bring out our guest this evening. Our guest is the head of commercial seasteading with the Seasteading Institute, and he's tasked with planning for the economic and financial challenges that individuals and firms aboard seasteads and the seasteads themselves will be facing when the Institute's vision comes to fruition. Very pleased to have you with us, Max Marty. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So we've got a lot to cover, and I just said the word seastead a lot, and I've already seen one of our listeners in the chat room say, so what's this whole seastead thing about? So we're going to define it, and we're going to get into what it all means. But before we do any of that, I want to tell you about a little survey that we ran on the Speculus website earlier this week in preparation for our program. I don't know, Max, if you saw this, but we did a survey on future habitats.
Okay, I have not seen it.
Okay, so good, you can participate now. This will be fun for all of us. Okay, so the first question on the survey was, which future habitat are we most likely to see in the next 50 years? And here are your choices, okay? Domed city, underwater city, seastead, underground city, Space Colony, Full Immersion VR World, Other, Describe, or No New Habitats?
So are we assuming, can I ask any questions?
I'm sorry? Yeah, you sure.
Can I ask any questions?
We're friendly.
So are we assuming a sort of steady progression up in technology? No singularities or anything like that, right?
You can answer it as you see fit. I didn't put any preconditions into the question, so you can answer it however you like.
Okay. Well, of all those choices, I would say in 50 years, the absolutely most likely one would be the virtual world, the VR scape one that you mentioned.
Fascinating. So the Seastead guy goes with the full immersion VR world. I'm impressed. Stephen, what was your answer to that question?
I said Seastead. Isn't that funny?
Actually, so did I, as a matter of fact. I was just keying off the answering my own question, just keying off the word most likely. Because it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, Max, that things have to be invented in order for us to have a full immersion VR world. Nothing actually has to be invented for us to have Seasteads. People just have to start doing it.
That's true.
That was my rationale.
But,
so.
Right. And so I would imagine that we would have at least some Seasteads out in the world, perhaps, at that time. But if you were to ask me which one is going to be the most surefire likely to happen, I would say that it's almost inevitable that at some point, probably in the next 50 years, we'll have a VR-style world.
Well, and this raises question two. So in which future habitat would you most like to live? And then here are the questions. The responses are domed city, underwater city, seastead, underground city, space colony, full immersion VR world, other, describe, or none, I'm happy right here.
Well, this may be my bias, but I would have to say full immersion VR world, because with that you can essentially live in whichever of the other ones you'd like to live in most.
And change hour by hour, right?
Yeah.
I'm tired of this underwater city. I think I'll live in a dome city. I think I'll live in the Lando Calrissian city in the clouds, right? Whatever you want to do. How about you, Stephen? What was your answer on that one?
Well, I love that answer. But I had actually said the space colony. And so,
okay, well, that's very interesting, because I can tell you guys, as I look at the results, the most likely future habitat, Max, you'll be interested to know that our number one response was Seastead, and number two was VR World. And coming in third place, a little behind the other two, was Domed City, and the rest didn't really place. Not a lot of votes for space colony being terribly likely. I'm a little disappointed that there weren't more votes for Underwater City, to tell you the truth. People just seem to have lost their ability to dream or something. I don't know. But on question two, the number one answer, preferred future habitat, is, in fact, space colony. And that's the space colony has risen in the last few hours, because last time I checked, it was a tie between VR world and space colony. So Stephen, you're in the most popular group there. People want to live in space colonies. But Max and I, we're going to be in a VR
colony,
world, and we can be in as much outer space as we want to, right, Max?
Yep. By all means.
Well, so my idea of the space colony was basically a space colony with a holodeck. That would be pretty cool. So there's your VR world. So.
There it is,
exactly.
You can do it either way. You can live in a virtual space colony in a VR world, or you can have a virtual world within your spaceship, like on Star Trek: The Next Generation. Very nice. Okay, well, enough of that. That's fun, but now we've kind of talked around it. So, Max, why don't you step us through very basically what do we mean when we use the term seastead? What is a seastead?
So, seastead. The word is actually a play on the word homestead, except S-E-A instead of H-O-M-E. But it means a city-state on the water where people can live, work, love, and enjoy life.
What's the difference between a seastead and a cruise ship?
Well, a seastead would be a place where you could live more permanently than you could on a cruise ship. But it would also be a place where when a bunch of people gather and intend to live here, they could hopefully start to design their own legal systems, their own economic systems, their own political systems in ways that you wouldn't be able to get on a cruise ship right now, which essentially is running the legal system, a modified version of the legal system of a typical first world country, for example, the United States.
So one of the things that's interesting about this is that unlike a cruise ship, as you said, it's a permanent residence on the sea. It's you're living there. You're setting up a more or less permanent dwelling in the ocean. But the distinction, I guess, between a homestead and a seastead is when I think of a homestead, I think of an individual or a family, and a seastead would actually be a community. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that would be fair.
So, who's interested in doing this and why?
So, I guess there's a number of people that would be interested in doing this for various different reasons, right? There's been possibly as many people interested in doing this, as many reasons as there are people interested in doing this. So, for example, some of them may just want a place to test out some new ideas they may have for public policy. Let's say they think, well, I love the rules in Singapore that have to do with this and that, but I love the rules in France that have to do with that and the other. What if I can combine, go to some place that sort of combines the best of both worlds as I see it? So that may be one reason to live there. Others may simply be looking for, you know, a better life for themselves or their families, be free of, or perhaps to be free of what they would consider onerous regulation of one aspect of their lives or another. Other people may be motivated simply by the pursuit of profit, right? So there may be, there will certainly be businesses of various sorts on these platforms, and that's certainly one motivation. And finally, a lot of people may be interested in doing this or in at least seeing this happen because they're interested in the sorts of innovations that these platforms, these new city-states in the ocean, the sorts of innovations they could bring back to traditional land-based governance models.
Okay, so let me challenge that just a little bit. If you want to innovate with governments or if you want to change the way the state works, why not get involved locally where you are and try to modify the system there rather than moving out into the ocean and starting something completely new?
So that is definitely one way to potentially change public policy, for example. But so most people, when they want to get involved in public policy, want to get involved in some way that's big and important and scales. But that's very difficult to do at the local level, of course, because the rules that you may affect, let's say at the city council level, aren't number one, they only affect a small limited number of people, and number two, most of the important rules that are generated today in governance come from Washington. Right, so things are becoming more centralized, not less. Federalism, that is the sort of the sovereignty of each individual state, so to speak, is eroding over time, rather than the opposite. So if you want to have any big influences on public policy, what you really need to do is influence nationwide elections, and that is very difficult to do, especially at an individual level. So if you come up with a whole bunch of money, you may be able to do it a little better. But still, you have to sort of deal with the usual games that people get into in politics. So what pressure groups are, what public action groups are going to be in your favor, which ones are going to be against you, who do you need to get on your side, do you need to get in bed with the unions, or do you need to get in bed with specific businesses, or what kind of compromises do you need to make. So essentially, you're looking for one-size-fits-all policies against the entire populace of a country, and that's just not particularly easy to do.
Right. So the alternative is go start a new, much smaller state someplace else where you can kind of get it in on the ground floor, I guess, as it were.
Right, and that's not the only alternative. I mean, you could also say, I don't know, become a revolutionary and take up arms or something, right? But most people don't want to do that, myself included. You know, I don't particularly want to take up arms against anybody. So much better, not to mention it's very difficult and you know, likely to just get everybody killed, rather than any
yeah,
meaningful change happening.
Not a great idea on a lot of fronts, for sure.
Right.
Well, think about it. This is another way of looking at it, Phil, is, you know, if you've got, say, 10 Seasteads out there and, you know, 9 of them have bad ideas, but one of them starts doing well, then, you know, basically you have a lot of different chances to succeed. And then the one that succeeds will be emulated by perhaps the less successful Seasteads. It's like getting all your eggs out of one basket in a way. Max, do you see it kind of that way sometimes?
Yeah, most definitely. It's very much like an evolutionary model. It's where, like you were saying, one, you may have a big play field full of different sorts of Seasteads. You know, imagine a world with 100 of them, and each one is trying something different. And, some of them may stumble upon, much like biological evolution, may stumble upon really good ideas that get copied and allow it to grow and attract essentially more people or more customers or whatever you'd want to call them, and hopefully also get copied by governments back home.
I wonder if just to be devil's advocate here for a moment, how applicable is it really when you put a system together for a small, isolated group of people out in the ocean? Is that really something you could reverse engineer back to a traditional nation state with tens or hundreds of millions of people?
Well, yes and no. I think we see a lot of, for example, small countries in Europe that are essentially have a lot of people who look very similarly and talk similarly and think similarly, and those city-states tend to work. Those states tend to work very well, because of that sort of homogeneity that you find among the populace. So people don't seem to disagree so much when they all look like each other. But when you get into larger countries such as the U.S., you find that those same sorts of rules that work in one sort of population won't work nearly as well in another sort of population, like you're saying. I think the answer to that is, again, trial and error. So some of them may work well, some of them may not. And there's a number of filters. When it would come to trying out these new ideas in an old traditional land-based governance model like the U.S., there's a lot of filters that will essentially slow everything down so much that I wouldn't worry too much about rapid change in that industry occurring in the U.S.
Right. Yeah. It seems to be fairly well set the way change occurs, if at all, in our government set up currently. How about this question? If you were to break down or just kind of sample the folks who are interested in seasteading and do a straw poll of what motivates them to do it, how much of it is a desire to try out new political systems versus how much of it is a desire to just kind of get away from it all and go see what's next or do what's new, and how much of it is just pure? This is an accusation one of our guests made when we talked. When this subject came up a few weeks ago. How much of it is just trying to get away from paying taxes?
Well, actually, right now we don't have very many of the latter. So
okay.
there aren't nearly as many people who are coming to us and saying, "Well, I'm really interested in this idea just because I don't have to pay taxes or I don't have to deal with some XYZ regulation on my business or such."
Right.
Not that we'd be opposed to that. You know, I think there's a lot to that, and we can talk more about that. But that's not one of the biggest groups that are interested in right now. Right now, I'd say that a lot of people are the sort that are interested in it from an academic perspective of saying, you know, what would be the sorts of new legal or political systems that can be tested out in these environments. How would they look? Who would want to be? Who would be interested in them? How long would they last? Et cetera. So we do have a lot of academics sort of interested in that question, and we do have a lot of people also who say, you know, I'm really interested in just going out there and sort of going to the frontier and seeing what new sorts of people and ideas pop out of there. and really want to be a part of it in that sense.
Yeah, that's the part that would appeal to me, I think. Although I've got to come clean and say, and if this makes me a bad person in George Borsky's view, I'm going to have to live with it. Not paying taxes also sounds pretty good to me. I would actually be okay with not paying taxes. What about you, Stephen? If you were to do it, what would motivate you to see Stead?
Well, I have to say paying a smaller share of what I earn in taxes would be pretty awesome. I think that seasteading could be a great place for innovation in that you could try things like in medicine that the FDA may be standing in the way of, maybe slowing things down. I think there is a place for exactly what you're talking about where innovation can't happen in other countries, and I think a really good seastead could end up leaving some of the more traditional nations in the dust in some of these ways. So yeah, I guess in answer to your question, paying less taxes. Also being a part of some exciting innovation, both great things, both great reasons for getting out there and doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of it just sounds like fun. I mean, it sounds like an adventure to go start something like that. And another question about this, Max, just to explore this a little bit. We're talking around kind of innovative government ideas. Can you lay some on me that some are considering that they might? Things that might be tried out that are unfamiliar to us, or that that maybe haven't had a chance to be tried in a large nation state that might get a go in a seastead.
Sure. So, a lot of the people who are, and this is a big one in a seasteading group. A lot of people who are interested in what we're doing are interested in, for example, biological enhancement. So they may say, well, I'd like to, or life extension, right? So they may say, I'd like to go to a place that would allow, stem cell therapies and other biological enhancements that the FDA certainly hasn't approved of yet, they're not even really approved of in other places. But I feel like I'm sort of a sovereign entity unto myself, and that I should have the right to try this out. And that's certainly one model we're looking at. Another one that people are very interested in is sort of a libertarian state. So libertarians are a political group that feels usually pretty marginalized and underrepresented in traditional, at least U.S. politics. And so a model where they could test out a lot of the ideas, a lot of sort of neoclassical ideas on how to live and, what rules and regulations and such are the government's business or not. That's certainly another model that can be tested out.
Those two might actually go pretty well together. That in a pure or something approaching a pure libertarian state, don't know if you could ever get there all the way, but in something gulch like out there in the ocean, that would be I would think an environment where there would be no restrictions on what a person would be able to do in terms of enhancing their own body or modifying themselves or right. I mean, it seems like those two ideas kind of go together.
Right, yes, most definitely. And interestingly enough, we also had another group of people who've been coming to us and saying that they'd like to try out their own models in this environment, which is a lot of people in the green movement. So we've had people who are very interested in constructing sort of completely self-sustaining in terms of energy and food and that sort of thing, a seastead, and seeing how they can test these various models and these various forms of living out on the ocean. And I think a lot of this is motivated by a desire to live in a world where everybody around you is operating under a similar set of rules. So it's certainly like creating a community that, in a sense, couldn't be created back on land.
Interesting. It would seem that one of the potential risks there would be kind of creating a sort of a homogenous or kind of an echo chamber, a society with less diversity in it than we have currently in our existing states.
Right, and yeah, and that's one of the dangers that I would see in this happening. But thankfully, I think there's enough diversity of views, certainly, in what we're doing, that a world with 1,000 seasteads in it would probably have a number of them, let's say, I don't know, 100, that would be these sort of isolated communities of people who think similarly. But a lot of them would also be on the other side of that spectrum, right? They would be the most diverse places in the world because they don't need, they don't have visa requirements, or they might not have stringent requirements on citizenship or whatever it may be. So they may attract a number of people from all over the world and become sort of a cultural melting pot. So I definitely think we get a diversity of that.
Okay. So, yeah, it's like you get to diversity a different way, maybe. That's kind of the trick there. Here's a question from the chat room. Sally asks, would seasteaders be able to really push new technologies faster than we could on the mainland?
So the sorts of technologies that I see being pushed more quickly on a seastead would be the sorts of technologies that, for one reason or another, are not easily pushed on land. So, for example, medicine is a big one, right? So if the FDA moves very slowly, the ability for people to experiment with medications that they would see fit, for example, you know, there's the usual example of the person who's about to die from some cancer, and there's a new treatment that's being tested, but they can't get into the trials, and of course they would still want to do it because they would otherwise die, and they have nowhere to go. Well, this would be an alternative for that, and with one way in which you can innovate on that front. But really the one that I would find most interesting is the political and social and legal innovation, which is something that unfortunately happens at glacial speed back on land, and that's probably the one that I would see being most pushing the envelope on a seastead.
I wonder if this would work. It's an absolute monarchy. We'll call it Gordonia. Stephen, you're in charge, okay? Kind of a benevolent dictatorship, seastead. What do you think?
Well, the first thing I would do is say, no, you can't call me. You can't call me Your Majesty. I would step down and be Mr. President. You know, like George Washington. You know, so.
you're, okay, you already blew it.
That
forget
good
it.
Of a guy.
I'm not wasting it on you. Okay, that's not innovative at all. That's already been done.
Well, okay, let's call it. Bowermaster Onia. What would that look like if you were to be the benevolent dictator of your own seastead?
Yeah, I think that is kind of the first impulse you have, actually, to be, well, the first thing I would do is I'd set all my subjects free. And that's kind of the...
Exactly.
I'd tell them all, look, we're all the same here, so let's have a good time.
Let's try out the flat tax, see what that looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Although I would let them continue printing currency with my face on it, I think, you know, just in honor of the fact that I freed them all. I think that would be fair. Okay, so let's talk a little about the Institute itself. How did it get started, and what kinds of things are you working on currently?
So the Institute was founded by Patrick Friedman and a couple of years ago, and it got started when Patrick had a conversation with Peter Thiel, founder of PayPal and one of the big investors early on in Facebook. And he told Peter Thiel of this idea, and Peter Thiel agreed that it was a great idea and said, hey, I'll write you the check, and you can get started trying to see if you can put this idea into action. So Peter Thiel has been our biggest funder so far. We've had a number of conferences and things like that have looked into what the engineering problems would be with a platform out in the ocean, what would be the best way to get this done. And now we're also going to be looking into the legal questions, and in the past year we've also started looking deeply into the economic and business questions and the financial feasibility of doing all this. So we're really just, at this stage, we're really just researching how do we get past the various hurdles that are in front of us in order to make city-states in the ocean, in one iteration or another, a reality?
And is there a front runner for implementation methodology? I know I've this has probably been a couple of years ago, so I'm not up to date, but I've heard about ideas around things like abandoned oil rigs or reclaiming coral reefs and turning them into islands, or taking cargo ships and putting like a small flotilla of those together and building out from there. Are those the kinds of ideas that are being looked at, or are there new, more surprising approaches that are being looked at?
Well, it depends on whether you mean for the short, medium, or long term. But so for the sort of short to medium term, we'd like to be able to build some sort of platform. For example, it would look something like imagine an oil rig, but one that doesn't actually drill, disgusting black substance out of the ground, but instead is a nice place to live with nice views and you can have your pleasant fish on board. But of course, this is would be a very expensive project. So we actually contracted with an engineering firm a while back, and turns out that this project would probably cost around $100 million. So we'd ideally love to get started a little smaller, something sort of a proof of concept. And so we're looking at the first implementation of this being something like a retrofitted cruise ship or a retrofitted large vessel of some sort that could be made as a good place to live and a good place to do business.
And is anyone actually working on making that happen now, or that's still kind of in the design stage, or is it actively being pursued?
So no one is actually testing out these new political systems on the ocean, but a lot of people are using international waters to do things that, of course, can't be done in a nearby country. So one example of this is the casino industry aboard cruise ships, right? So that, in a sense, can be thought of as going out into the ocean in order to get away from laws that are probably there for other reasons besides being ethical reasons. So there's also been a number of groups that have tried to create either large vessels in the water. For example, there was a group called the Freedom Ship back in the late 90s. Or have tried to found their own countries in the water on board. For example, there was one called Sealand, which was on an old anti-air fort that was outside of the UK. So I think the biggest problem for those groups has been essentially economic. So the guys who were trying to build a freedom ship wanted to take advantage of economies of scale, which, of course, when you have a large city, the network effects of that are wonderful. But they also needed some sort of incremental model to prove the concept on a smaller scale. It didn't seem feasible that they were going to convince investors to plop down a couple billion on this gargantuan ship without anything to show for it first. So these groups either couldn't really get started, such as the Freedom Ship, or they had nowhere to go. They had no room to grow, such as the anti-air fort in the UK.
Right. So I guess the trick to getting something like that going is either you populate the ship with rich people or who are able to afford to keep it going, or you've got some kind of business, you've got some kind of economy actually occurring on that ship. It's in the business of doing something that sustains the existence of it.
Right. And so there is a model that is being tested and tried that is only, like you said, it's only a place where rich people live. And this is called, it's called Residency. It's available right now. You can still go out there and buy units from somebody who would be willing to sell their units. And the problem with these units is they are incredibly expensive. So I think the lowest ones start at over $1 million, possibly significantly more than that. If it was $3 or $4 million or something, but they're very expensive, and their yearly fees are also very expensive. And as it turns out, even the rich people who decided to buy property on that ship didn't decide that they actually wanted to live on that ship. So the ship is right now sailing around the world, but it's usually only at about a quarter occupancy. So, and of course, one of the biggest problems with this model that they had was that it's not a very productive model. So there's nothing that is actually being produced on this residency that the rest of the world would want to consume. And so it's not the best place to live.
Well, it's
a
retirement home. I mean, is that the idea? It's like senior housing. It's like a cruise ship that goes on for the rest of your life. Is that kind of the idea? Sort of like you're just retiring at sea. Is that kind of what they're doing?
Right. They're either retiring at sea or they like to have a place where they can bring friends on board when the ship is going to some place that's interesting. For example, the ship was most populated. I think it might have reached even half occupancy. Maybe it was a third, but I think it was half. Back when it went down to Antarctica.
Hmm. Interesting. So there's a leap. There's a conceptual and I guess a set of logistical and technical and legal hurdles that have to be overcome in order to get from a model like that to something that's truly a sustainable community. And one of those, I would think. And I just want to test how big of an idea this is, but one of the real challenges that a seastead would face would be recognition of its legal status. The idea that, you know, this group of people who've come probably from a number of different nations who are now aboard this vessel or living in this residence, whatever the thing ends up being, are no longer citizens of the countries that they've come from, but they're now citizens of this place because this is now a sovereign entity. How does a seastead go about establishing itself as an actual sovereign entity that is recognized by either international bodies or by other countries?
Well, there's certainly the sort of de facto answer and the de jure answer. So de facto means in fact, and de jure means sort of by law or legally. So in fact, for any country to be recognized, what it essentially needs is for other countries to have a reason or some benefit to actually recognize them. So the example that comes to mind is the U.S. and China. Right? The U.S. didn't recognize China as a sovereign entity, as a state, for quite a number of years after other countries had already recognized them as a state. And, of course, one can argue whether or not that was a good idea or a bad idea, but what it shows is that it comes down to politics. So whether or not you're recognized depends on sort of, you know, how big you are, what sort of political friends you have on your side, which ones you have against you, whether it's useful for those other politicians in other countries to think of you as a nation or not, because it essentially to get into a number of international bodies such as the UN, you need to be voted as recognized by a number of current members. And so that is something that certainly for seasteads would be a very long way off.
Yeah. Am I right that most vessels, on the seas, take the flag of one country or another while they're out on the international waters? And so, if let's say a big ship from a country somewhere flying the flag of some country, and then they decided to say, okay, now we're an independent nation, the country whose flag they're flying might have something to say about that. They might say, no, you can't just unilaterally decide that you're now an independent nation. Am I seeing that wrong, or is that kind of what you guys have thought about?
No, that's about right. Certainly if you're part of, let's say you're flying the U.S. flag and you suddenly decide that you don't want to be part of the U.S., well, you can't exactly do that. You could lower your flag and suddenly say you're not part of the U.S., and, in fact, if you're not flying a flag, you are essentially considered a stateless vessel, which might as well be a euphemism for pirate. And as far as international law or domestic law is concerned, they can board your vessel, they can seize your vessel, they can do with you as they please. because you really have no sort of legal protection for recourse the way laws are currently set up. So what most vessels end up doing, or what many vessels end up doing, is just flying something called a flag of convenience. So for example, Royal Caribbean flies a flag from Liberia. And the first reaction is, well, why in the world are they flying a Liberian flag? And the answer is that Liberia essentially sells Royal Caribbean the right to use a flag. And this is a competitive market, right? There's a bunch of small countries in the world which have nothing better to do than make a bunch of money by selling flags. And so a number of these countries will sell vessels a flag, and then essentially they wash their hands of the problem. They say, here's your flag, and go have fun, and don't tell us what you're doing. We're not interested, and we wash your hands of you. And that sounds like a great solution for seasteading, at least in the short to medium term.
So, because in that example, even if Royal Caribbean cruise ships were to suddenly decide they're no longer beholden to Liberia in any way, it's not like Liberia is going to do anything, right? It sounds like they're not really exercising any control over them currently.
Right, right.
Other than collecting their flag fee, I guess.
Yeah.
Yep.
big point of interaction. So that would be it sounds like that part would be fairly manageable. I guess it's more the economic and just the kind of inertial issues of getting one of these going. What's your take on timeline? When do you think there will be, as a person who's looking at economic and business interests of this, when do you think there will be one up and running? By what year?
Well, I think the first piece will probably be up and running somewhere between 2 and 3 years from now. And that would look something like a retrofitted cruise ship, and then something like an actual platform city-state, something bigger out in the ocean, might be 5 to 7 years. And then before we see sort of a world full of seasteads actually competing one with another and causing the innovation we've been talking about, I would say maybe somewhere from 15 to 20 years.
Okay, so within the next couple of decades, there could be a couple 100? Dozen, you think, or more, or what's your scenario?
But there could potentially be, depending on the technology that is created in order to get these things off the ground. So, for example, if good breakwaters exist that make the wave sort of a non-issue or a very cheap issue to fend against, then I think we could see hundreds, maybe thousands of these things out in the water.
Wow. Interesting. Well,
can I give a perhaps a scenario, Phil, how this might work?
Go for it.
Imagine a large cruise ship, flying the flag of Liberia or whatever, parked in the out in the Gulf somewhere, the Gulf of Mexico. Far enough out there in international waters, and set up perhaps sponsored by a large and wealthy hospital to give treatments that for whatever reason wouldn't be available in the United States. You could have cruise ships leaving out of Miami, and docking with this city state out in the Gulf on a regular basis. People coming in, getting treatment they need or desire for what and then cruising on back home. That seems to me it's almost so obvious. It's one of those things. Why hasn't it already been done? It seems like it would work.
The analogy to gambling on cruise ships is kind of interesting there. Here you're talking about instead of allowing gambling, you're going to allow unregulated medical treatment, and this entity would be outside the control of any particular sovereign state. I assume you can achieve that somewhere out in the Gulf of Mexico. You can be in international waters and not be under the control of any Mexico or the U.S. or Cuba or any Caribbean country. You're just there, right? So,
right. I think the answer is that yes, you can do that.
Okay, so if that were to if something like that were to be established, Max, what do you think? That it sounds to me like that would be that would be reasonably sustainable, although people aren't going there to live, right? You know, it's like they've set this thing up to make money, but the doctors working there and so forth, they aren't necessarily interested in spending the rest of their lives there. That might be the one thing that would distinguish that from a real seastead scenario. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, most definitely. So for example, there are already cruise companies that own small islands out in the Bahamas, which they bring a number of passengers out to these islands that are wholly owned by that particular cruise company, and they go out there and, you know, have a good time and then come back home. There's no reason why they wouldn't be able to go out to platforms which have their own entire regulatory and policy structure that's really made around what would be best for example, people coming off cruise ships. So if that could be done, that's certainly one model. Though, Stephen, I would sort of push back a little bit against the idea of it happening in the middle of the Gulf, only because, and I think Matt Ridley and the Rational Optimist would back me up on this one, you want to be about as close as you can to a city, to a large center of commerce, in order to have a lot of interesting things happening, rather than being far away. So as close as you can possibly get while still being in international waters, which seems to be about 24 miles, would be ideal.
So perhaps you park 24 miles off the shore of Miami or something. You get just outside the U.S. waters where boats can come and go quickly and easily. Okay, I'll buy that.
Well, why Miami? Why not New York, right? The big city up there. I guess maybe the climate's not as favorable for having a
well, New York would be better in one sense. No hurricanes, or fewer hurricanes in the New York area. So, so there you go.
There's always going to be trade-offs, I guess, with this sort of thing. Interesting. So what do you think, Max? Is that is that sort of kind of bootstrap new outside of the coloring outside of the boundaries business model likely to kind of get the ball rolling on this, or will it be more people like those who've joined the Institute and who've taken an interest in it kind of making it happen through just the desire to move out into the frontier?
So I think if you look at other examples in history of large projects that have gotten off the ground in sort of inhospitable places, because let's admit it, the sea is not nearly as hospitable to humans as the land. What you see in sort of in past historical projects is that people need a reason to go out there. There needs to be some great productive resource that you are taking advantage of by going out somewhere and living there where you might not otherwise want to be. So the resource that seasteading, I think, will offer is the right sort of rules and policies to play under to make interesting things happen. And I certainly think that business models and business in general and productivity is what's going to lead at least the first people out of the seasteads, because my guess is at least the first ones won't be nearly as fun places to live as living back on land. If you play a lot of World of Warcraft, then it's not so bad if you have an internet connection. But
right.
You certainly can't go climb the mountains and bike around all day if that's what you enjoy. So it's going to take a, sort of a pioneering spirit.
Okay. Well, and I think there's a lot of that out there. I think there's a lot of untapped pioneering spirit out there. So look forward to seeing developments of that. The Seasteading Institute can be found at seasteading.org. So if you're interested in more information on that, check them out there. Max, enjoyed talking with you. The time went by really fast. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Stephen, so that's our discussion on seasteading. We're going to have to invite Max back again soon, I think. We're going to have to explore this idea a little bit further, but I was real pleased that we got the Matt Ridley reference in without even my having to bring it up. So we're staying true to our rational optimist theme here on the program.
Absolutely, that's right.
Okay, well, I promised there'd be a big announcement, and here comes the announcement. So I hope you're all sitting down. Beginning November 1st, we're going to start having more Fast Forward Radio. If you like Fast Forward Radio, you're going to love this, because beginning November 1st, beginning that week, Fast Forward Radio is going to, no, not two times a week, we are going to start being on three times a week, three times the Fast Forward Radio for your enjoyment. So we're looking forward to bringing that to you. Now, Wednesday evenings will still be our kind of flagship show. That's when we'll be live, and if we have a new guest, that will be on Wednesday evenings. But Monday evenings, we're going to start rebroadcasting the entire series that we've done on Blog Talk Radio. Unfortunately, we don't have the earlier shows, but beginning back in 2007, we'll start broadcasting those shows. And on Saturdays, we're going to be rebroadcasting a special annotated edition of The World Transformed. So Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturday mornings, Fast Forward Radio, I guess it'll probably run about 2 hours on Saturday because those shows were 90 minutes to begin with. But that's all leading up to, coming in January 2011, we're going to be presenting The World Transformed 2, Live to See It. I know we've been promising this for some time. It has been somewhat delayed, but it's going to be great. It's going to be very exciting. We're going to be bringing back a number of the folks we spoke to last year, as well as some new voices, and we're going to be talking with them about how people like us, people like you, listening to this program, can become involved in making these transformations happen. So if you're interested in a world transformed, if you're interested in being part of a world transformed, that series of programs is going to be for you. So look forward to that. Put it on your calendars. Starting the week of November 1st, Fast Forward Radio, three times a week. What do you think, Stephen? How psyched are you about this?
Man, very, very psyched. This is, you know, it's appropriate. It's coming in the holiday season. You know, this is our gift to you.
So. Our gift to the listeners, absolutely. Three times the Fast Forward Radio, and we're gonna keep bringing it to you live every Wednesday night. Next week, we're actually going to be talking. Oh no, who was our guest? I'm sorry, Thomas McCabe. Excuse me, will be with us Thomas McCabe is going to be with us from Humanity Plus, talking next week about that organization and where things are going with that. And we'll be here every Wednesday night, and starting in November, every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday. So, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Okay, let's see here. Tonight, I'm Losing My Mind by Woodfish. So I hope this three times a week is going to work out. Are we losing our mind?
When I went from losing my notes to a song called Losing My Mind by Woodfish. All right, Stephen, well, thank you so much for putting that together. Thanks once again to our special guest, Max Marty, for being with us. All of you participating in the chat room, listening live or listening via recording, thank you for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again at the regular time again next week. And until then, live to see it.
I think I'm getting it back. I think this brain has got enough shit.